Police reform is front and center right now, and some activists and politicians are calling for officers to live in the communities they police.
The idea is that if you live and work in a community, you'll be more likely to have cultural competency to understand that neighborhood, and you'll be more invested in it, to have a stake in that community.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, September 17th, the challenge of police residency requirements. Plus, tech company Oracle is close to partnering with TikTok, but the government still needs to approve the deal.
A lot of the tech companies that we've seen come under intense scrutiny in Washington have been the public-facing ones, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Twitters of the world. And this would be Oracle really stepping into potentially a lot of that scrutiny.
And the very white world of classical music and how it can work towards diversity both on and off the airwaves. In the months following the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many others, calls for police reform are reviving a long and contentious debate over whether or not police officers should live in the communities where they work. This week in Louisville, Kentucky, the city settled a wrongful death suit for $12 million with the family of Breonna Taylor after months of protests demanding justice. The settlement outlined a series of police reforms, including a housing credit program, to incentivize police officers to live in certain areas of the city. And in Rochester, New York, following the police killing of Daniel Prude, Mayor Lovely Warren recently announced a proposal that would require new police officers to live within the city's limits.
Having our police officers live in the community that they protect and serve will build relationships and strengthen our neighborhoods. I think that you also get a chance to get to know your neighbors when you live next to them. You're outside cutting grass, you're talking to each other, and that's very important.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we explore whether requiring officers to live where they work can lead to meaningful change. For more on this, I'm joined by Mark Claxton, retired NYPD detective and director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Grace Hauck, breaking news reporter at USA Today. Grace, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Grace, why are we hearing a lot more renewed attention on these residency requirements?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of police reform that people can get their heads around. And many cities are starting to think about adding this to a whole host of new police reforms. But as you mentioned at the top, this is not something that is new. This is a discussion we've been having for more than a century now. And as the mayor mentioned in that clip, the idea is that if you live and work in a community, you'll be more likely to have cultural competency to understand that neighborhood, and you'll be more invested in it, to have a stake in that community, and you'll be more likely to reflect the demographic composition of that neighborhood. You may have a more diverse police department. And so the idea is that it's trying to improve police community relations. But throughout history, there have also been some economic incentives for having these requirements. So it's partly a move on the part of cities to try and retain some officers who were taking part in white flight, fleeing out to the suburbs, and also a public coffer theory. So the idea is that the cities were having high rates of unemployment. They were in financial crisis. And so by implementing these policies, you were keeping the salaries that you were paying to civil servants in this local economy, and you were also retaining that tax base.
Mark, this has been an issue that recently here in New York City, in fact, has taken hold. The mayor of New York, Mayor de Blasio, was recently really put to task, if you will, to have to release data on where New York's NYPD officers live. You've been in the NYPD. About half of those officers right now live in the city of New York. How do you see it from having worked in there? Is it important for them to live in New York City or in the cities that they police?
I agree with the legendary rapper Rakim, who said it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. But in New York, I know the issue has been brought up for over 30, 40 years, maybe even longer than that. I know throughout my entire police career, there was discussion about the importance or relevance of residency, because the police officers in New York are allowed to live within the five borough and contiguous counties. And I think the police unions put up the most resistance to any stricter residency requirements. And part of the position that they've taken over the years is that their civil servant, their blue collar police officers can't even afford to live in the geographical area of employment. So the out of boroughs tends to give them a better opportunity for home ownership. But more importantly, residency, and the reason it's coming up as of late is because of all of the reform ideas and the reform agenda that is traveling around the nation. And it's a comfortable, easy, some say lazy, suggestion towards reform. And I think most important in regards to police residency is the fact that police culture really subsumes all other culture. When you're a police officer, there tends to be the dominant culture is your police culture. So there is no additional sensitivity based on your proximity. And people have to be mindful of that. If they're looking for the idealistic Joe Cop, it's not necessarily a residence requirement that gets Joe Cop next door to you, helping you cut your grass, et cetera. And there's a difficulty in obtaining a lot of conclusive data on the efficacy in reducing police abuse or criminality. It's hard to quantify whether or not there is an actual benefit to requiring residency. And then finally, if you look at nationwide, there are areas of this nation where it is impractical to require residency. And the best policies regarding police reform would require a nationwide institution. So it's very difficult and challenging to really enforce or encourage the different jurisdictions across the nation to require a residency for their police officers.
Grace, one of the things to that point, I'm wondering, is there data that show that any of these residency requirements have an effect on improving community police relations?
So, you know, in reporting this story several weeks ago, I reached out to Eisinger, several of the other academics who were studying this during its resurgence in the 70s, and they really can't point to any recent surveys or data that suggests that this does improve community relations. I've also reached out to various community members for their thoughts on this, and I hear all sorts of opinions, but there really is no tangible evidence at this point. And, you know, Mark was saying there are various ways to get to Joe Cop. And in 2015, the Department of Justice under President Obama released a report on 21st century policing. And that report did not suggest a residency requirement. There was no evidence for that. So what it said instead was a residency incentive program. So providing officers with housing in public housing neighborhoods, as long as they are fulfilling their duties within that neighborhood. And it seems that the settlement we see in Louisville is trying to get at a similar idea, maybe not requiring officers to live in the city, providing incentives. And the settlement also is requiring or encouraging officers to do community service in those neighborhoods. So again, to Mark's point, they're seeing that as the way to try and improve these community relations as opposed to necessarily forcing officers to live there.
Mark, when you hear about those types of financial incentives, what are your thoughts there? I mean, do those, because frankly, you know, and you know this as being an NYPD, a former NYPD officer, a lot of the folks that are being policed, particularly in Black and brown neighborhoods, we're talking about low-income communities generally, and a lot of these cops are living in suburban communities and surrounding areas where there's also just sort of a disconnect, an ideological disconnect, it seems, that tends to show up. So is incentivizing officers with tax breaks or credits to live closer to the people that they police worth it?
Well, first off, I think the ideological disconnect that we tend to see is based on what I mentioned previously, and that is police culture and how impactful police culture is And that can cause, actually built into toxic police culture is kind of this us against them mentality, which clearly would have impact on their ideological position. Secondly, I think it's an effective way to encourage police officers to conduct themselves differently is to either do one or two things, incentivize or penalize. There's no shift in police culture or dynamics or treatment or conduct or behavior without either A, incentivizing or penalizing. That's the only thing that gets through. Negotiations don't work with the police and police entities, generally speaking. And once again, that's part of the dynamics of police culture. So if you expect police officers to voluntarily engage in a program that requires residency, then you would have to incentivize it. If you are trying to keep them from living outside of the jurisdictions, then you have no choice but to enforce penalties against them.
Grace, when we talk about, given that, I mean, let's talk about the communities themselves, right? Are communities that are policed, particularly those that are heavily policed, interested in this type of contact or connection with the officers? Do they care based on your reporting?
Yeah, so I think Minneapolis might be a good example here. So in 2017, the city was thinking about taking up a residency requirement because just 8% of officers were living in the city that year. But a local Twin Cities-based organization, Communities United Against Police Brutality, actually opposed it that year and said that we don't want this residency requirement. We don't see any evidence that this will help us. And actually, to quote them, they said, "We've never encountered a shred of evidence that requiring or incentivizing police officers to live in the communities in which they work has any positive effect on the quality of policing. I've heard from some residents in Minneapolis, as well as where I am here in Chicago, who say, you know, I don't like the police. I don't want these officers in my neighborhood. That's going to be traumatic for me, and that will cause stress and fear. At the same time, there's a community organizer here on the south side who told me a couple weeks ago, yes, I would love to have an officer who's not just living in the city, but living in my neighborhood, you know, coming over for dinner." She said something along the lines of, you know, "People who are neighbors aren't going to bash each other's heads in. You're going to be less likely to shoot a young man if he lives a few blocks down and you know his father." So it's a debate at the very, very local level, all the way up through the systemic city official and police union level as well.
So, Mark, given that this has been debated since the 19th century, and we're obviously not going to solve it today, but I do want to ask you about how you achieve community, quote unquote, community policing with or without a residency requirement.
It definitely does matter, and it improves responsiveness when there are well-established interpersonal relationships between the police and the community.
Mark Claxton is a retired NYPD detective and the director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance, and Grace Hawk is a breaking news reporter at USA Today. Mark and Grace, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Think of a famous classical music composer. Okay, now think of another. I'll bet the names that come to mind are white men, maybe from the 18th century, maybe wearing a wig. Well, last week, the classical music world got even less diverse after Garrett McQueen, the only Black classical announcer at Minnesota Public Radio, was let go for, quote, "making changes to programming." In a statement, Minnesota Public Radio said, quote, "We have a process in place for changing playlists, and that process exists to maintain our more than 200 partner stations' compliance with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and to ensure royalties are properly paid for the music played." Here's how McQueen responded to the dismissal on his podcast this week.
"Do I acknowledge that my actions were against the rules of the company I worked for and could potentially result in my termination? Yes. Do I acknowledge wrongdoing? Absolutely not. Anti-racism is at the very top of my list of core values, and doing what I can in the field and profession that I landed in to promote equity and anti-racism is not only my will, but my duty and responsibility.
McQueen's firing has reignited conversations about representation in classical music, including among composers, musicians, audiences, and yes, radio hosts. Terrence McKnight is the evening weekday host for WQXR, the classical station for us here at New York Public Radio. Terrence, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Also joining me is Dr. Aaron Flagg, a trumpet player, chair of jazz studies at the Juilliard School, and chair of the League of American Orchestras Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee. Aaron, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Terrence, let's give a landscape to our audience here. When we think about classical music stations in the United States, how big are there? How many are there? And within that universe, how many are hosts of color, Black hosts particularly?
There are a few hundred stations around the country that are considered classical music stations. And, you know, I don't know, Tanzina. I'm not sure how many Black announcers there are out there. I really don't know. I can tell you that when we go to conferences, you know, we don't see many. But it's, you know, it's a tradition in the industry. You know, you think about classical music, radio station going back to the 20s and 30s, and you know, segregation was rampant in our country, and you know, some of the biggest radio shows back then were like, you know, Amos and Andy, and so those shows were sort of radio minstrel dramas, and they just miseducated our country about Black people, and as a result, you know, we're not having a lot of Black voices representing classical music on the radio.
And you're one of those few Black voices that we have, and we're proud to have you here at New York Public Radio. Terrence, how do you think about musical selection when you think about your audience for classical music on air?
Well, you know, we think about the diversity of New York City, and we think about all of the classical traditions around the world. We think about telling stories that can engage people right where they are. For example, I'll give you an example. I live in Harlem, and I live in the section of Harlem that's right by Little Senegal. And so there's a composer, a Black composer named Joseph Boulogne, whose mother was Senegalese. And just for example, this is something I do when I play Joseph Boulogne's music. I'll say, oh yeah, you know, Boulogne, his mom was Senegal, his mother was Senegalese, so she probably spoke Wolof. So Nangadev to all of the Wolof speakers out there. Now, that's just something that I do in case a Senegalese happens to be listening to the radio at that time. They'll hear, oh my goodness, somebody's speaking Wolof and talking about classical music. This is for me. So I usually try to use little signifiers to really broaden out the conversation. Whether I'm playing Western European music or not, I think there are ways in which you can engage your audience to engage the diversity in the city that you're living in. And that's what I try to do.
Aaron, let's bring you in here, because I was classically trained at LaGuardia High School for clarinet back in the, dare I say, early 90s, which is right down the block from Juilliard.
All right. Yeah, actually, our son went to LaGuardia High School. He graduated just last year. So we're following in your footsteps.
Oh, I would be so humbled if that were the case. But I really do, you know, there were diverse students at LaGuardia at the time, but the higher up you go in the hierarchy of classical music, there is a lack of diversity, or there was back then. Today, Aaron, do you see more exposure to classical music for audiences of color? Are audiences becoming more diverse? Who's going to the orchestra, for example?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, what you probably saw when you were in school, and what my son saw and I saw when he was in high school and now college, as it relates to participation in classical music, remains terribly low, as our recent study in the League of American Orchestras report relating to professional orchestras tells. This has been a embarrassing and consistently low trend in terms of not just players on the stage, managers, audiences, as you were referring to. So the engagement of all people with this incredible music remains at a terribly low level.
Terrence, when you think about, you mentioned playing music, for example, from a Senegalese composer. What difference does it make to have audiences hear music that come from outside the core, quote unquote, classical canon?
I think it, you know, I mentioned segregation and minstrel shows. I think when folks aren't accustomed to seeing, you know, black men in tuxedos or black men writing classical music or black women conducting classical music, when they see that, it opens their eyes. And for that little brown girl that sees that, it opens up a new avenue of what she could become and what, you know, she can be or what he can be, because now they see somebody that looks like that uncle or that auntie or somebody who's written music that, you know, speaks that language that they're accustomed to. So I think it just makes us all more human and all more open to the capabilities that we're all, you know, potentially able to accomplish.
Aaron, when it comes to classical music, how important is classical radio in terms of reaching audiences today?
It's critically important. It was the window for me growing up in Los Angeles, pretty very poor part of Los Angeles, to the wonders of classical music. I'll never forget at 12 years old turning on the radio and hearing Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which is sort of named the Pastoral Symphony, and looking out my window, which I can tell you had no fields in it of grain, but in my mind's eye, I saw a whole world that I had never been to. Because of the beauty in that music and how it communicated to a kid in South Central. And so the access that the classical radio in general gives to the world, we all know this from, you know, Voice of America, just communicating not only art but ideas and stories, is critically important. And the playlists that radio stations put in place, the hosts they put in place, communicate value. Communicate importance. And Terrence's arrival in the New York area in 2008, man, we were dancing in the streets almost literally to have someone who looks like us, someone who did not leave their blackness at the door when they got onto the mic, who also loves this music the way we do. It meant a great deal, and it still means a great deal, and it's so important.
Terrence, I have to say that is quite a thing that we hear a lot about in public radio, just the lack of diversity, but particularly in classical music. How, Terrence, did you first get introduced to classical music?
Yeah, well, classical music goes way back to my childhood, you know, with piano lessons and trumpet lessons in school. Did you know I played trumpet, Aaron? Yep, I did.
I heard. We're going to do it. We're going to bring out those duets, man.
I was going to say, we could start a band here. Go ahead.
That's right.
Yeah, I started trumpet in elementary school and, you know, just played piano through school. But in terms of radio, when I got to Morehouse, I wanted to supplement, you know, what I was learning in theory and history. So I started listening to the radio. And one day I was listening to a show and I heard the radio host talk about the Cleveland Indians. And I grew up in Cleveland. So he's like, oh, the Indians are going to beat the Braves in the World Series. I'm like, who is this talking about baseball and Beethoven? This is really interesting. And so I became an avid listener to this radio show where this host really brought me in by talking about something that I loved and music and talking about sports and putting them side by side. And I thought, oh, I would love to be a part of this. I would love to talk about music in a way where people could access it, where it didn't seem like it was something foreign or something distant or something they had to aspire to, but something that they already loved and something that they wanted to just experience a little bit more. And that's how I got into classical radio.
You know, I'm wondering, we had a caller at the top of the segment here say that, and I was singing along with him, say that his introduction to classical music was through Bugs Bunny. And I recall the film, the Disney film Fantasia. Mm. And so there were some entry points for kids in particular to get into this space that didn't feel as staid and as old, as you will. But I'm wondering, with budgets being cut across the country for music training, for music classes, how do we get children, Aaron, as you mentioned, and Terrence, both of you sort of, you know, having exposure to music through that way? How do we get kids to, particularly kids of color, to have access to this music and begin to see it beyond what they may not hear on the radio? Aaron.
Well, clearly exposure is like Terrence and I just shared, is key. If you don't hear it, if you don't see it, If you're never given the opportunity to interact with it, how could you get enamored with it? So I think it's all of our responsibilities, be it the radio stations, orchestras, schools, anyone who has the training, like Tanzina, you have on clarinet and trumpet, to not hide that, to share that. Even learning that today added another layer to my appreciation for both of you. So I think we sometimes forget as individuals, you don't have to be a professional musician like an Anthony McGill or others at a current orchestra to have a positive impact, to say, hey, this is important to me. It's an important part of my background. And that takes the professionals coming out of the Mount Olympus, if you will, and the kind of Prometheus descending idea of we're just going to share this and then go back up to the mountain, to actually be amongst the people. And I think one of the impacts of COVID, trying to find a silver lining to some of this horror, has been musicians going out in the streets and playing and communicating, string quartets, just playing on out in front of people's stoops and in parks, and just exposing the world to these instruments, let alone to this music. And I think even more importantly, in a way, to how essential it is to our existence as human beings. And people can feel that. And I'm reminded finally of many YouTube, I'm sure you've seen these examples of people filming themselves reacting to listening to different types of music.
Yes.
And the surprise of hearing Pavarotti's voice for the first time and going, you know, even someone who's never heard it, it connects. There's no way you can deny the power of that. The power of Robert McFerrin singing Eri Tu, I heard in Houston, I just was knocked out. I've never heard anything like that. So it's not an issue of, well, people aren't educated enough, or you need to read 3 history books before you can understand the power of Duke Ellington to Wagner. That's silly. It's a human thing. And we need to just make sure it's in front of people, and that role models are also important. But we know from studies that late middle school into early high school is when we lose students from considering continuing their artistic development. And the reason we lose them is not because of talent necessarily, it's because they're of encouragement. They need to get the catalyst of you can do this.
I'm curious here, because we've got about a minute and a half left, right, and I want to make sure we get this question. And Terrence, particularly in your chair, your audience has expectations about what they want to hear, right? Isn't the audience also sort of pressuring the host to sort of play the canon that they're most familiar with? And I think about a segment we did here on The Takeaway about Black opera. And I think most people would say, well, of course, Porgy and Bess. But beyond that, our knowledge of composers of color, Black composers in particular, new forms of classical music, is very limited. How do you manage that, Terrence? We got about a minute left.
I think, you know, whether it's conducting, programming, whether it's just talking about music, traditionally, this has been the domain of European Americans to talk and perform this music. And to this point, I don't think audiences have demanded anything different. So the change has to come from within. The change has to come from within these organizations, because you have, you know, people who have studied the form. They've been around music a long time. So there has to be the will inside the organization to show the audiences something different, and they'll fall in love with that too. Show them a mix-up of traditional music from different cultures, and audiences will fall in love with that, and they'll follow this just like they've been following how classical music has been programmed over the last 100 years in this country. So the change comes from within.
That's something that we here at New York Public Radio and at WNYC, and I think newsrooms across the country, are having a racial reckoning of sorts. But specific to classical stations, what types of changes should they be adopting, and how can they break out of these old paradigms of playing, you know, the classics, if you will, the greats, but also introducing new sounds?
Yeah. When I got into radio, I started at that show I mentioned, Performance Today, up in D.C. And Performance Today was looking for a musician who was passionate about radio, a musician who was passionate about communicating with audiences. So I think by having a musician, You know, we think musically, so we don't think in terms of boxes. You know, we don't think in terms of genre so much. So musicians are always trying to get find ways to make music interesting and performance interesting, and find looking for ways to get music to respond to music. So for me, it's always a, you know, there's no difference in an Otis Redding love song and a Schubert love song. These were both men talking about love, and oftentimes it involved a piano. And so for me, if I'm talking about a theme, I can go across genres and cultures and time, because I'm trying to connect people together and I'm trying to bring people together. And I do that by bringing music together. And I think if stations tried to do that, you know, looked out into their communities and saw who was there and tried to find ways to really engage all of those folks through music, I think that would, it would require changing the programming scheme. And I think that's what people respond to.
Aaron, when you think of, I mean, you recently wrote a piece for Symphony Magazine looking at the long history of racism in U.S. orchestras. And as we sort of touched on earlier, that, you know, when I was at LaGuardia and performing in their orchestra, there were artists of color there, including myself. But as we went higher and higher up, I didn't pursue the career, and many of my classmates did not pursue that career professionally. How do you see this legacy of racism in U.S. orchestras today?
Well, I want to actually connect my answer to what you asked Terrence a minute ago.
Sure.
In terms of how, what are ways? There are many different ways. There's not the way. There are ways to do this. And although I respect Terrence's approach in terms of embracing theme-based programming, if you will, I think there's a plenty of diversity and richness to be had within classical music itself. The fact is, due to systemic racism and conscious and eventually over time unconscious exclusion, in the genre of classical music, there are wonderful composers who have just been thrown to the side, who have not been, their music has not been published, it's not been recorded, it's not been included in history books. So the music teacher who taught you at LaGuardia, perhaps, people who are teaching at universities and conservatories around the world, they are just ignorant of the music that exists that can be played. That thanks to the reckoning that is happening now, and you asked me earlier about differences from when you were in school to now, although the numbers haven't changed drastically, what I do think has changed, and I should mention, is the consciousness has changed. You know, I am the faculty advisor for the Juilliard Black Student Union, and the sense of ownership of identity and empowerment is significantly greater now amongst that group of students. So I think in terms of getting to the profession, we have to recognize all these incredible stumbling blocks along the way that have an impact on discouraging young students of color from seeing themselves in the profession. Because the profession, as you note, as you go further, there is less diversity ethnically and gender-wise in the repertoire being done because the teachers are ignorant. And so there needs to be a humility and a willingness to learn, to do some research, to dismantle our own embrace, even if unconscious, of white supremacy. And you noted the article I wrote, Anti-Black Discrimination in American Orchestras, which lays out, amongst other wonderful works, of course, those systems so that we can see them. I often say we live in a world that is much like the Matrix in the movie, where we're blind to what is actually going on. And so great composers are just assumed to be great, and that's all the great composers there are, which is a lie. And so we need to dismantle that. And as we do that, people will see themselves as being welcomed into this incredible field. And but it takes a lot of anti-racist work, which is individual as well as collective.
It also, I would argue, to a certain extent, to our earlier point about this access for children, it also takes money. I was only fortunate enough to have a very dedicated music teacher in elementary school who said, "You're going to play the clarinet." I had no idea what a clarinet was in the third grade, who sat with me for, you know, zero period, 7 a.m. I would get there early. She would teach me. I had an equally generous music teacher in junior high school who prepared me for the entrance audition at LaGuardia free of charge. These were dedicated educators who saw something in me And yet, I did not own my own instrument. I did not own a piece of sheet music. I was woefully underprepared when I was accepted to LaGuardia in comparison to the rest of my classmates, just in terms of access. My mother buying me my own clarinet, which I still have, was an event. So how do we level the economic playing field, Aaron, for people trying to access this world? And Terrence, if you have thoughts on that, I'm happy to hear them as well.
Well, my reaction to that is much like your story, the people who came into your life to pour into you and into your talent and into your potential. That is the same experience, although maybe differently framed, for all of us. I had the same thing. I remember getting to Juilliard as an undergraduate. I had one little beat up trumpet, and I learned on the second week that every other trumpet player had five trumpets. I said, well, honey, yes. For a piccolo, for a C-trap, like, what? I've never heard of these things. And so I think a way to address that is, one, to explain the game. This is how the game works. The way we actually currently explain the game is meritocracy, which is a facade. We say, oh, if you're talented, you'll get all of these things. No, that's not really true. If you have people who will support you and pour into you and make it possible for you to do these things, and you have interest, which, like my mother used to say, I can take it, you can draw a horse to the water, but you can't make the horse thirsty. So I think our field needs to embrace the idea of finding thirsty people and investing in people who are thirsty. And that goes across gender and socioeconomic status. But that requires, back to your point of money, it requires all of us at every level to commit to the cause, as colleagues of mine just recently did in putting money together, these are musicians, for a scholarship fund at the Music Advancement Program at Juilliard to help kids like you and I directly. So I think leadership in saying this money is needed, and then putting your money and time where your mouth is, rather than us wringing our hands that music education has, you know, I've been talking about that for 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, like, music education, we're not pouring it. And after a while, I'm hearing myself say that, and I say, stop saying that and do something.
I always give a shout out to Miss White and Mr. Cohen, who made this, for some reason, their mission to encourage this in me. Terrence, who should we be listening to? Who are some of the new voices or the more diverse composers that we, you know, we played The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by Joel mm-hmm. Thompson at the beginning of the show, which was one of the songs that Garrett McQueen played. But who knew Joel Thompson? I mean, how do we get to know these new voices, and where should we be looking for them?
Yeah, I want to address that, and I want to go back to what you said earlier, Tanzina, because, mm-hmm. you know, you being having a young child, I was thinking about, you know, children emulate, you know, so if your son watches you listening to, you know, classical music and enjoying classical music, there's a chance that he'll grow up and he'll be, you know, comfortable around that music. And in terms of, like, because I bring that up because you were asking about getting children involved, I think children, you know, kind of emulate their parents. Also, in terms of financing this thing, I remember growing up, and I would always say to my mother, oh, Mom, why don't we buy a new car? Mom, why can't I have those sneakers? And she's, because I'm sending you to piano lessons. So I think it's all about, sometimes it's about choice. And sometimes it's about the choices that the parents make, how they decide to raise their families, and what choices they make monetarily about what's important. So I think those are two things. And I watch my parents make choices and make sacrifices so that I could study music, and mm-hmm. my siblings, you know, study, you know, art and music as well. So those were choices that we made as parents. And then in terms of who we should be listening to, I think, you know, I'm kind of an insider because I'm talking about music all the time, and I'm always kind of listening and talking to composers and researching this stuff. So, you know, for folks who don't spend that kind of time with music and the art form, I think, you know, the radio, like Aaron said, is important because the radio and radio hosts tend to try to be, you know, curators of the culture in a city, you know, and we talk about what's happening at Lincoln Center or what's happening at the Schomburg or what's happening at Studio Museum or what's happening at Carnegie Hall. So or what's happening in Brooklyn. So we're always trying to inform our listeners about culture as well as providing music. And, you know, some of the documentaries I've done over the years, you know, Florence Price, you know, the first black woman to have a symphony played. Nobody was talking about Florence Price 20 years ago. We had kind of forgotten her. And, you know, I did a piece on Hazel Scott. Hazel Scott, you know, she was a fabulous pianist who went to Juilliard, you know, when she was 9 years old. And she, you know, the classical world didn't embrace her. So she ended up what she called swinging the classics. You know, she would take a classical tune and, you know, and make it swing. And so that became her thing. So I talked about her. And there are some, you know, there are lots of black, you know, and brown composers and performers who are out there. And we play their music on the air, and, you know, we're having conversations with them. And you know, I think the progress has been incremental, but it's a long tradition of Western European music being, you know, the entertainment for Western Europeans. And when the music came to America, we failed to really plant it in American soil, you know, and let it flourish in American soil. We really essentially tried to keep it as was and bring it, you know, lock, stock, and barrel to the United States and make it work. And we've been struggling at that. You know, in the 60s, orchestras were very, you know, they were the most stable cultural institutions in our country. That was in the 60s. They received a lot of money for that. But as our country becomes more diverse and more brown, you know, brown folks want to hear, you know, and see brown folks up there making music. And your stories about, you know, African and you know, Latino cultures and Asian cultures and the cultures that they represent. So I think that's where we have to go. We have to be more inclusive.
Right. If I may just add on to that, we're in such a historic time right now, at least from my perspective, with the reckoning, just this conversation happening and so many others around the country, that I am optimistic that people are starting to get the message of the willingness to do the work. So I know at Juilliard, we had all of the chairs of the music department sitting down over the summer and saying, you all need to find five pieces by people of color that you've never heard of before. Go research them, come and recommend five to everybody else. And there were so many of my colleagues, several of whom were my teachers when I was a student years and years ago, who were like children discovering Dorothy Moore and Kermit Moore and some other wonderful composers, Adolphus Hailstork and William Grant Still's pieces that they didn't know about at all. And these are, you know, senior professors at the Juilliard School. And because the provost said, this is what you need to do, go find five pieces and share it with each other, that ignited a change where we followed up to change our audition repertoire, in at least in my area, my department, to where all the etudes that were required at the time were by dead white men. They're wonderful etudes. But the challenge was that the door was open to say to the faculty, isn't there anyone else who has written an etude that will allow you to see what you need to hear from the applicant? Isn't there any woman who's written something for the clarinet, saxophone? And so that just that question and the mandate to go find it is almost like Kennedy's affirmative action. You know, get me someone else to guard the president of this country who looks like other members of the citizenry. Go do that. So it takes the willingness to and the authority to make that happen. And those are small changes, but I see them happening at schools around the conservatories around the country, where because of what's happening in the country now, people and the COVID virus, if I may add, are forced to think about this and reflect and address the reckoning.
Terrence, you would be proud to know that I did play Mozart's Serenade for Winds Gabriel when he was in utero, and he already has some instruments waiting for him to go. Terrence McKnight is the host for WQXR.
There you go.
I'm sorry, say that again, Terrence.
I say talk about change coming from within, case in point.
Literally, it's one of my favorite pieces of music. It's one of the most gorgeous pieces of music, and obviously I'm partial to it because it is dominated by Winds, but I just played it and thought, all right, let's start here. Point is very well taken. Terrence McKnight is the host for WQXR, and I'm sorry, Terrence McKnight is a host for WQXR, and Aaron Flagg is a trumpet player, chair of jazz studies at the Juilliard School and chair of the League of American Orchestras Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee. Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
We want you to be part of the Takeaways Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our conversation every day.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
TikTok could soon have a U.S. media partner. ByteDance, the Chinese company that owns TikTok, has chosen the American tech company Oracle for the role. The move comes after the Trump administration signed two executive orders aimed at forcing ByteDance to sell TikTok's U.S. business over what the president says are national security concerns. But the deal isn't done yet. It still needs to be reviewed by the U.S. government. Here's what President Trump had to say yesterday.
No, I'm not prepared to sign off on anything. I have to see the deal. We need security, especially after what we've seen with respect to China and what's going on. We want security, so I'll let you know.
Cristiano Lima is a technology reporter at Politico, and he talked to me earlier this week about what we need to know about the deal and its implications for user privacy. But first, I asked him to explain exactly what Oracle does.
They're one of the biggest tech companies out there, but certainly under the radar, particularly in Washington. So they do a lot of cloud computing services. They provide supply chain tools, data management. Certainly not the things that most people associate with tech when they think of Facebook, the social media companies, but definitely a major power player in the industry that provides a lot of indispensable services for lots of businesses.
So they're not really a front-facing technology company that we think about when we think about like what tech companies we know off the top of our heads. Why would Oracle be interested in buying or partnering with TikTok?
That's what makes this such an interesting move for them. A lot of the tech companies that we've seen come under intense scrutiny in Washington have been the public-facing ones, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Twitters of the world. And this would be Oracle really stepping into potentially a lot of that scrutiny by taking a potential stake, a partnership role in TikTok, which has faced its own political headwinds in Washington, not only on these national security issues that are getting so much attention now, but also along the lines of privacy and content moderation issues. But it is a company that has seen its user base really expand this year in 2020 with a lot of people staying at home on their apps, scrolling through the popular videos. And so it certainly was a very appetizing company for a lot of its suitors that were pursuing the company. And it's a chance for Oracle to really sort of step up its profile.
So can you tell us a little bit about what they actually are going to do? I mean, what is the deal?
So the specifics of it have not been announced. We're still waiting on the review process as well that the federal government is undergoing. What we do know, TikTok and Oracle confirmed this week that they've agreed on a deal that would make Oracle a technology partner to TikTok in the U.S. Now, this is in response to the Trump administration's actions in August. They had signed two executive orders, basically trying to pressure TikTok's parent company, which is ByteDance, a Chinese-owned tech giant, to sell off the company because of fears around that Chinese government officials could harvest American user data off the app. So the deal now, while the specifics are unclear, there have been several news reports suggesting that ByteDance is likely to retain a majority stake in TikTok, and Oracle would have a minority stake in the company. And so that still raises a lot of questions about how exactly it's going to address the security issues that we've heard from the Trump administration and officials on both sides of the political aisle.
You just mentioned that President Trump has been going after TikTok for a couple of months now. Is this, where does this stand with the Trump administration? Are they going to examine this deal a little more quickly or a little further? Or where does Trump stand right now with this?
So it's currently under review to look at these national security implications that we've talked about. The president, at least publicly, he has not said whether he believes the deal will be approved, but he just yesterday praised the company, which Oracle, which he has sort of close ties with. Several of its executives have openly embraced the president, and he has done the same in return. So he said yesterday that he expects a decision to come out very soon. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin earlier this week had said that the administration is reviewing it this week. There is somewhat of a deadline this Sunday. One of the executive orders, the deadlines for TikTok to cease its operations in the U.S., it hits this weekend. So it's possible that they will try to complete it before then. But it's also possible that we'll see this complicated review process over this deal, that the details of which are still very murky, might drag on beyond that.
There has been, I mean, part of the reason people say that President Trump has been going after TikTok is because it's a Chinese-owned company, at least. What role have trade tensions between the U.S. and China played in this deal?
Right. So this is certainly the latest chapter, the latest saga in the ongoing trade dispute, something that really bogged down the talks over the potential sale or partnership of TikTok with an American company was after Trump had signed his executive orders, trying to get this very profitable and popular Chinese tech company into the hands of an American company. China sort of pushed back, and they are seeking to make it so that certain parts of the deal would require their government approval as well. So clearly, this is also a part of the global tit-for-tat that we've seen between these two major power centers. And it also fits into some broader debates about the technology space, because American technology industry has been very profitable, obviously very successful. And TikTok is seen as sort of one of the biggest rivals to Facebook and Google and YouTube. And so this fits into that, because it would be giving an American company a stake in one of China's darlings in the tech space.
And there, of course, are privacy concerns with TikTok, at least according to the president. Are those concerns real? And would the deal, I guess, with Oracle, or would the partnership with Oracle sort of relax some of those concerns right now?
Yeah, so that's the big question. And one of the biggest things to look for in this is how the data storage and how TikTok will be able to wall off its data from that of its parent company in this deal, potentially. That's something that a lot of lawmakers on Capitol has said needs to be a big piece of this deal, because the concern is, as long as ByteDance has some control over TikTok, there's the possibility that Chinese government officials might seek to use that to gain access to some of this valuable American consumer data. So certainly officials in the administration, lawmakers, will be looking to see, how is this deal going to impact that? How will it wall off ByteDance and potentially Chinese government officials from getting access to that information? So that'll be a key piece of this deal that's still being ironed out.
Christiana, where do things go from here? I mean, TikTok is not in danger of being shut down right now anymore, is it?
Well, so the president had set two different executive orders that had deadlines that sought to push the company basically out of business in the country. Clearly, this deal is seeking to appease that without, to avoid that scenario, while not perhaps taking as drastic a step as having ByteDance sell off TikTok entirely. But it's unclear whether that's really going to satisfy the Trump administration. We've already seen some Republican senators say that the proposed deal, as it's been reported, does not go far enough, that there needs to be more. One particular Trump ally has called for the administration already to reject this deal and say that ByteDance needs to pursue fully selling off TikTok in the U.S. to an American company. So we'll have to see if Trump and the administration thinks that it goes far enough or not.
Well, we'll be watching, both literally watching TikTok and watching this story as well. Cristiano Lima is a technology reporter at Politico. Cristiano, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, courts across the country have been closed to in-person hearings and jury trials, forcing them to do these digitally or just postpone them. And that's caused a massive backlog in cases throughout the United States, with cities like New York and San Diego sitting on thousands of unheard criminal cases. Immigration hearings, child support orders, custody battles, marriages, and even arraignments for lesser crimes have also been delayed or postponed, leaving many Americans wondering when their legal affairs will finally get sorted. So today, we're going to begin a series of conversations about how COVID-19 has affected our national courts, and we're calling it Justice Delayed. And my first guest in this series is Lyle Moran, a legal affairs writer for the American Bar Association Journal. Lyle, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how bad are the backlogs?
Well, you know, out here in San Diego, for example, you have a backlog of roughly 20,000 criminal cases. That's, you know, about 2,700 that have been set for trial, another roughly 8,000 to 10,000 in the pretrial phase, and then you have 7,000 defendants awaiting arraignment. And so here in San Diego, next month, they're going to start up in-person jury trials again, starting with just a couple at a time. So at that pace, I mean, this is going to take years for this backlog to be worked through. So you have other courts facing similar backlogs, and you know, it's just going to be a while before these cases can get heard.
What happened? I mean, for those who aren't familiar, I've covered arraignment courts here in New York City, and this is they pretty much move very quickly. I mean, you see multiple folks coming in and out of arraignment courts, often sometimes, you know, within a matter of minutes, a judge has already made a decision. With this backlog, Lyle, what's happening to the folks who are waiting?
So, you know, there's obviously folks in a few different types of situation. For those, you know, charged with very serious crimes, especially violent crimes, some of them may be awaiting these hearings, arraignments, pretrial, and the like, still in custody. And especially in a time, you know, with COVID going on, you know, there's many that have sought relief from, you know, custody, given the prisons, the jails. You know, they're obviously areas where a spread has happened and folks are in tight quarters. So that's a concern to, you know, those being charged as well as defense lawyers. So you have that. You also just have the issue where it took courts a while to, you know, get up to speed with being able to hold video conferenced hearings. So, of course, you have some of those taking place. I just, you know, recently spoke with a judge in Louisiana in Jefferson Parish who has set up a system where he's able to accept guilty pleas via video conference. So at least for those defendants who want to take that route, they're able to have their pleas accepted and get some sort of, you know, resolution rather than waiting and having, you know, this unknown play out for a while.
Now, are these backlogs happening across the country in different places, Lyle?
They are. And, you know, it very much depends on how quickly a court was able to, you know, switch to using some of this technology to be able to start holding hearings again. You know, criminal cases have obviously been prioritized over civil. So civil matters, which already, you know, in many states took a very long time, years often, to get to trial. I mean, those have been put off even further just because you have many more, you know, constitutional rights in play in the criminal cases. You know, out here in San Diego, there was actually a group of local civil lawyers that came together and got some retired judges on board to set up a system where those folks who wanted to have a retired judge or a qualified local attorney hear, you know, their civil matters could go and do so for free. And the idea was a program like this would help reduce the backlog when, you know, the courts already have, you know, civil matters pretty much in abeyance for a while.
Lyle, what about some of the other things we mentioned at the top? Because if you're saying civil cases are really being put on hold here, what about people who are trying to get married or people who are fighting for custody or people who are trying to get a divorce?
It's a great question. So, you know, clearly during COVID, there have been a number of different types of child custody issues that have arisen. You have parents who have very different views about how the COVID-19 should be managed, you know, how seriously to take the health issues in play. You know, there have been concerns if, you know, one parent has to transport a child to another parent who's living in an area where COVID may be spreading more rapidly? Do they want to do that? And so, you know, I've been told that family courts in general are saying the pandemic itself is not reason enough alone to halt sharing custody or providing visitation to the other parent. The Texas Supreme Court even put out an order pretty early on saying that, you know, child possession schedules, as they call them, were not to be impacted by COVID-19. And I saw that in Wisconsin, the stay-at-home orders there made clear that, you know, travel to transport children pursuant to a custody agreement, that type of travel was exempted. So in large part, even though, you know, parents may have a different view about how, you know, what type of precautions to take during this time, you know, child custody sharing is supposed to continue.
Well, and if they're trying to go to court to amend any of that, that's what could take a while, right?
Exactly. The parties would need to agree to arrangements on their own and then have the court sign off. But to have the court try and decide on its own, that could take a very long time.
Lyle, are we we got about a minute left, but you mentioned that how long the backlog is in San Diego. Are some cases just going to take years and years? Are people, you know, potentially going to give up?
You know, I think you may actually see a lot more folks try and reach settlements because they're just not getting the resolution that they want. So there's certainly already in the criminal justice system, you have a lot of, you know, plea deals taking place, and we'll probably see even more of those.
Lyle Moran is a legal affairs writer from the American Bar Association Journal. And don't forget, we'll be covering more of this on our series, Justice Delayed. Lyle, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show for today. We've got another week in the books. Thanks so much for joining us this week and every week. And I want to give a shout out to the team that helps make this show happen all the time. Our board operators are Vince Fairchild and Debbie Daughtry. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Line producing this week was Jackie Martin. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. And her crew is Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Polly Irungu is our digital editor, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is the executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter is with you Friday. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.